All right, deep divers, buckle up because today we are diving into a legal mystery that I gotta say really piqued my interest when I first saw it.
Oh yeah, this is a fascinating one.
Yeah, so we're tackling the question of whether or not there's actually a Second Amendment right to hunt in the US. And to help us untangle this, one of our listeners sent in this academic paper that it's pretty dense but really interesting.
Yeah, a lot of great research in this one.
But before we get too far, let me just give a quick shout out to our listener for sending this in. We really appreciate it. Okay, so the paper is titled Heller, History and Hunting by Charles W. Welch IV. And it was a looks like a student paper, working paper, I guess they call it, from February 2025. And this paper goes deep, like we're talking court cases, state constitutions, even hunting laws from the 1600s.
Yeah, real deep dive.
Oh, yeah, that's what
Yeah,
we do.
literally.
Exactly. So the paper's core argument is that hunting with firearms is, get this, historically protected under the Second Amendment. Right. I mean, when you read the Second Amendment, it talks about the right to bear arms, but it doesn't say anything specifically about hunting.
Right. Well, Welch starts by looking at the idea that the Second Amendment protects weapons that are in common use for lawful purposes, and hunting, historically speaking, has always been considered lawful.
Okay, that makes sense. But how do we even determine what common use means? Like, is my great-grandfather's musket, from the 1800s, is that protected?
Yeah, that's a great question, and this is where it gets a little tricky.
Yeah.
So Welch proposes this two-step framework to kind of figure this out.
Okay.
So first you got to ask, is the type of firearm common today? So like, yeah, muskets, not so common anymore.
Not so much, no.
So that's probably not going to be protected.
Right.
But the second part of the framework is the purpose of the firearm lawful, either now or traditionally? So even if a particular type of hunting isn't super common today, if it was a big deal back in the day, it could still be protected.
Okay, so like even if we don't use muskets to hunt anymore, if we can show that it was a really common way to hunt back in the 1600s or 1700s, it might still fall under that Second Amendment protection.
Exactly. Yeah, it's all about that historical context.
Okay, that's really interesting.
And he brings up this really fascinating case from 2016, Catana v. Massachusetts.
Oh yeah, I remember reading about that.
Yeah, this case was about stun guns.
Okay.
Not really related to hunting, but it's about this idea of common use.
Right.
So stun guns are a fairly new invention, right?
Yeah.
But at the time of the case, over 198,000 people in the U.S. privately owned stun guns.
Okay.
And the Supreme Court decided that that was enough to make them constitutionally protected.
So a specific number of people owning something can make it constitutionally protected. Like if 100 people owned a certain type of weapon, would that mean it's not protected?
That's a really good question, and it really gets at the heart of how we define common use, right? What's the threshold? Especially now that we've got technology rapidly evolving, new weapons emerging all the time. It definitely raises some questions.
It's like, where do you draw that line?
Exactly, yeah. And the paper digs into a whole bunch of other historical examples to try to flesh that out a bit more.
Well, I am definitely hooked now. So where do we go from here? What's the next stop on this historical treasure hunt?
Well, Welch takes us all the way back to 1805 in a case called Pearson v. Post.
Pearson v. Post. Okay, I'm not familiar with that one.
It's a case about a fox hunt, believe it or not.
A fox hunt. Okay.
Yeah, so you had two hunters that were both after the same fox, and they ended up in court arguing over who actually owned the animal.
Okay, I see where this is going. A fox hunt obviously involves weapons. So how does this case relate to the Second Amendment?
Right, so the court ended up deciding that the hunter who mortally wounded the fox was the rightful owner, not the one who was just chasing it. And of course, how do you mortally wound an animal?
With a weapon, yeah.
Exactly. So even though the case itself wasn't directly about the right to hunt, it shows how ingrained the idea of hunting with firearms was in early American law.
So it was just like assumed that hunters would be using weapons. Like it wasn't even a question.
It was just part of the fabric of society, yeah, just kind of like a legal background noise.
Wow. Okay, so we've got this fascinating case about a fox hunt, but the paper doesn't stop there, right?
No, it goes even deeper. It looks at state constitutions as well.
State constitutions, okay.
Now you'd think that they would all be on the same page when it comes to hunting, right?
Yeah, I would think so, at least back then.
Well, surprisingly, only eight state constitutions actually explicitly protect hunting rights.
Oh wow, really? Only eight. That's way less than I would have guessed.
Yeah, it's a bit of a surprise.
So what about all the other states? Are hunters just out of luck in those states?
Not necessarily, and this is where it gets really interesting. There's this case from Maine in 1986. Their original constitution only protected the right to bear arms for common defense.
Hmm.
And the court said that, well, that didn't include hunting.
Oh, so that's not good for the main hunters.
It was a pretty big deal, actually.
Yeah, I bet.
This ruling sparked a huge public debate.
I can imagine.
And in the end, Mainers actually voted to change their state constitution.
Wow.
To more broadly protect gun rights and specifically include hunting.
Wow, so it seems like even though hunting wasn't explicitly mentioned in a lot of state constitutions, people still saw it as a fundamental reason to have guns.
It seems that way, yeah. Really makes you think about how much, or even if, public perception of hunting has changed over time.
That's a really good point. But okay, this deep dive is far from over. We've got a lot more to uncover.
We've only just scratched the surface.
That's right. Stay tuned, because next we're going even further back in time to explore those hunting laws from the 1600s. Welcome back, Deep Divers. We are on a quest to untangle this historical mystery of hunting and the Second Amendment.
And we're going way back for this one.
We are. Before we even got to those court cases and state constitutions, we teased those, like, super old school hunting laws from the 1600s.
Yeah, we're talking colonial America, pilgrims, muskets.
Oh, yeah, powdered wigs, the whole nine yards.
Exactly. But what's fascinating is that even back then, they had really detailed laws about how hunting was supposed to happen.
Okay, so paint me a picture. It's the 1600s. Is it just like a free-for-all out in the woods? Can you just like blast away at anything that moves?
Not even close. They had rules, even back then, and some of them might sound pretty familiar, actually.
Okay, like what?
Well, for example, there were laws about needing permission from the landowner before you could hunt on their property.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right, like you don't want just a bunch of random people tromping through your field, scaring off all the deer you're hoping to bag for dinner.
Right, yeah, you're trying to like feed your family.
Exactly. And some laws even went a step further. They actually required landowners to give a clear warning to anyone trespassing before taking any action against them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so no setting booby traps for unsuspecting hunters.
So it wasn't like the Wild West out there.
Not exactly. There was definitely a sense of fairness, even way back then. But of course, it wasn't all sunshine and roses.
Right.
There were also laws that, reflected the darker side of colonial America.
Yeah, I imagine there were.
For example, some laws restricted enslaved people from hunting freely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, even on their enslaver's land.
That's a tough reminder that, you know, even as they were developing these ideas about rights and freedoms, those rights didn't extend to everyone.
Yeah, it's important to remember that part of the history, for sure.
Absolutely. It's a good reminder to be critical of the past, even as we try to learn from it.
For sure. But getting back to the hunting laws, some things really haven't changed that much.
Oh, like what?
Well, there were laws prohibiting firing guns within towns or cities.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Public safety, you know, was a concern even way back then.
I mean, yeah, I can't imagine I wanted, like, stray bullets flying through, you know, cobblestone streets.
Right. I doubt they were too worried about noise complaints, though.
Yeah, probably not so much.
But it's interesting, these laws specifically said that you could hunt outside of those built-up areas. There was even an exemption in some places for firing guns in public waterways.
Okay, so they were already trying to, like, balance public safety with, you know, the practicality of hunting for food or trade.
Exactly. And just like today, they had laws regulating hunting seasons to make sure people weren't overhunting and wiping out entire animal populations.
Oh, so sustainability was on their minds even way back then.
Yeah, it seems so.
Wow, that's pretty forward thinking for the 1600s. Were there any other like regulations that stand out as like particularly interesting or unusual?
There were a few, yeah. Remember those fire hunting laws we talked about earlier?
Yeah, the ones that banned hunting at night using fire to attract animals.
Exactly. Now, why do you think they would want to outlaw that?
Seems like kind of a recipe for wildfires, right?
That's exactly what they were worried about. It was about protecting the forests, not necessarily restricting gun ownership.
Yeah, that makes sense.
There were also laws against hunting on Sundays.
Oh, interesting. So like a day of rest, even for deer?
Right. Everybody needed a break, I guess. And then some laws restricted using hounds for hunting certain animals, like deer or elk.
Wait, really? Why would they restrict hounds? I always thought they were like super helpful for tracking and chasing game.
They were, but this was likely about protecting vulnerable animals. Hounds wouldn't be able to tell the difference between, you know, adult animals and their young, especially during the off season.
Ah, so it was about ensuring, like, ethical and responsible hunting practices.
Yeah, even centuries ago. And that's why this whole deep dive into these old hunting laws is so fascinating, right?
Hmm.
It shows that even with all these specific restrictions, there was this widespread acceptance of hunting as like a legitimate activity.
Okay.
Something that needed to be managed, not prohibited.
So it wasn't like seen as some like barbaric practice that they were trying to stamp out.
Nope, not at all. It was a fundamental part of life, and these regulations were just about making sure it was done, you know, sustainably and responsibly.
I see. So, okay, we've gone on this amazing historical journey,
hmm.
but how does this all connect back to the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms? Like, how does Welch tie all of this together?
That's where things get really clever. He argues that the very existence of these regulations and the way they were structured points to an implicit recognition of a right to bear arms for hunting.
Implicit recognition. You mean like it wasn't written down directly, but it was just like understood at the time.
Exactly. Remember that Pearson v. Post case about the fox hunt?
Yeah.
That whole court decision was based on the assumption that hunters would use weapons. They didn't even question it.
It's like using guns for hunting was just so normal back then that they didn't even feel the need to like write it down as a protected right.
Exactly. And it becomes even clearer when you look at how these hunting regulations were written.
Okay.
They regulated the time, the place, the manner of hunting, but they never actually said that you couldn't hunt at all.
So it was more like, you can hunt, but here are the rules you got to follow, not you can't hunt, period.
Exactly. And that's a really important distinction because it suggests that hunting with firearms was seen as this right. A right that could be regulated but not totally taken away.
Okay, so they're basically saying that the way hunting was regulated historically points to this underlying assumption that it was a protected.
It's like a legal whisper from the past. But we're not done yet. To really build a compelling case, we got to see if this idea of a right to hunt carried over into the 20th century, a time when, you know, gun control became a much bigger issue.
Okay, yeah. But let's fast forward to a more modern era and see if those historical whispers turn into a full-blown conversation. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. We've been on quite a journey, haven't we?
We have. Centuries of history, fox hunts, fire hunting bans. All to answer one question. Is there a historical basis for a Second Amendment right to hunt?
And now we're finally stepping into the 20th century.
Yeah, a time of huge change, you know.
Yeah, tons of advancements, but also those debates about gun control, they really started heating up, didn't they?
Absolutely. And it's not that we can really see how those historical whispers we've been uncovering, you know, they might have actually influenced lawmakers in a more modern setting.
So I'm curious, as society modernized, did hunting just kind of fade into the background? Or did it stay a key part of those gun debates?
Well, let's see. The paper points to some really interesting examples from congressional hearings that suggest hunting was still very much on the minds of lawmakers, even as they were trying to deal with things like rising crime rates.
Okay, I'm all ears.
All right, so let's start with 1927. Congress was debating this law to restrict sending concealable weapons through the mail.
Okay, so trying to keep dangerous weapons out of the wrong hands.
Exactly. But here's the thing. Lawmakers were very clear that this law should not apply to firearms that were used for hunting.
Oh, interesting. So even when they were trying to, like, crack down on crime, they were making a special exception for hunters.
Exactly. They recognized hunting as this legitimate, lawful activity that deserved specific protection.
Okay, that's pretty fascinating. I mean, I wouldn't have thought that hunting would be such a big consideration in a law about, you know, mailing weapons.
Right. But it wasn't just a one-time thing. This consideration for hunting, it pops up again and again throughout the 20th century.
Oh, really? Give me another example.
All right, fast forward to 1934 and the National Firearms Act, or NFA.
Okay, the NFA, yeah.
This law, it was targeting weapons like sawed-off shotguns, machine guns. Not exactly your typical hunting gear.
No, unless you're hunting, like, robots or something.
Yeah, exactly. But during those debates, a congressman from Minnesota, he actually raised concerns about the law potentially impacting hunting rifles that had shorter barrels.
Oh, I see, yeah. I mean, for certain types of hunting, you do need a shorter barrel, like for maneuverability if you're in dense brush or something.
Exactly. And you know what? Congress actually listened.
They did.
They amended the law to make sure those common hunting rifles wouldn't be accidentally banned.
Wow. So they were actively trying to protect hunting rights, even when they were regulating firearms that were, you know, associated with criminal activity.
It's like they were drawing a very clear line.
Yeah, they're saying these are bad, but these are okay.
Exactly. And this wasn't the last time hunting came up. In 1968, during those discussions about the Gun Control Act, huge piece of legislation, remember?
Yeah.
Passed in response to all that, you know, rising crime, the assassinations.
Right, right.
There was this real concern about how the law might impact quote-unquote decent citizens who just use guns for hunting.
So even in this climate of fear where everyone was calling for, you know, stricter gun control, hunting was still seen as a legitimate reason to own a firearm.
It really was. It makes you think about how much that perception has changed today, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. But the examples don't stop there, do they?
Nope. Even in the 1980s, when they were debating a ban on armor-piercing ammunition, you know, the really serious stuff,
yeah,
they actually made an exemption for ammunition that was specifically needed for hunting.
Wow, so even when they're talking about ammo designed to like pierce body armor, they're still thinking about hunting.
They were, and the paper uses this as further proof. You know, this repeated consideration for hunting by 20th century lawmakers just strengthens the argument that it's long been seen as a totally legit purpose to own a gun.
Yeah, it's amazing to see how this one activity, hunting, it's just woven into the fabric of American history and law.
It really
And it
is.
makes you think about how we view it today, you know? Do we still see it as this fundamental part of our culture?
That's a great question to ponder. Now, you also got to remember that the legal landscape, it's always changing.
Oh, yeah.
New court rulings, they could reinterpret the Second Amendment, you know,
Right.
and public opinion on guns, on hunting, that's always evolving too.
It's complex, that's for sure.
It is, with no easy answers. But thanks to this paper and our little trip down memory lane, you know, at least now we have a better grasp of the arguments.
We do so much deeper understanding now.
That's what it's all about, man.
Right? That's what the deep dive is all about. Thanks for joining us on this wild ride. Would love to hear what you think. Does knowing all this history, does it change how you see the gun debates today? What other lawful purposes beyond self-defense should we be considering when we're trying to figure out what the Second Amendment really means?
Let's keep the conversation going. Until next time, deep divers, keep on diving.